This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beersmith Podcast number 38. We've got a great show today on hop chemistry. And the one quick announcement, which I mentioned also last week, is we got Beersmith 2.1 coming out roughly mid-May. It has two major features new to it. One of them is a brew day timer, help you as you're walking through your brew day, kind of shows you the steps and plays an alarm as it goes to each step. The other one is the Beersmith Recipe Cloud, which is a new website that I'm launching. It'll be integrated with Beersmith, so you can share recipes across machines. And also share them with your friends, and there's a whole bunch of social media stuff built into it. I think you'll really enjoy it. So look forward to that launch coming up in just a week or so. And without further ado, let's jump right into this week's interview. Today on the show, my guest is James Altweiss, who is the president and CEO of Gorse Valley Hops at gorsevalleyhops.com. He's actually working to reintroduce hops into Wisconsin. It's great to have you on the show, James. How are you?
I'm doing just great. Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate you coming on. So I know, most U.S. hops are now grown in the Pacific Northwest, but I know that a long time ago they were growing all over the country because one of my great-great-grandfather, one of those guys, he actually grew hops in central New York is what he did for a living. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little about your mission to try and reintroduce hops into Wisconsin?
Well, what we're looking for is we're looking for a new, relatively new cash crop for our growers in the region. And, we knew that we could grow hops in Wisconsin. We've done it in the 1860s, much like, the folks in the New York and the East Coast regions there, they were growing them, starting in the late 1600s. Mm-hmm. So we said, we have an opportunity. We have a burgeoning craft brewer market, and they're, as artists, they're always looking for, a way to accentuate, their craft. So we said, we can bring them something from an ingredient perspective that maybe they don't have access to. And it's not that they can't get hops in other places, but they may not be able to get some of the quality attributes that we're able to provide on a small scale from a large-scale grower broker. So that was our intent.
So how's it going so far up there in Wisconsin? Is it starting to catch on?
It's definitely going well. That's for sure. We have more demand than we have supply. But the catch 22 there is, growing too quickly. We don't want to cut any corners on our quality because frankly, we can't compete on, open market price with right. the large scale brokers. It's just not going to happen.
Sure.
So we have to deliver something else, and that something else is quality. It's heavily dependent on process, both growing and processing, and that's volume based. So we've got to balance it very carefully with what the demand versus our growth capability. So,
sure,
but in a roundabout way, yes, it's going fantastic.
That's great. I'm glad you're doing well.
Thank you.
Well, today we're going to dive into hop chemistry a little bit, but I thought I'd maybe start with just the basics so everybody understands what we're talking about. Hey, can you walk over, talk a bit about, what a hop flower is, sort of how you grow it, how you process it, so people can use it for brewing?
Absolutely. Well, hops are what we call an herbaceous perennial. So what does that mean? That means that hops come back, every year. Don't have to replant them every year, but they die back to the ground every winter. So, these things are growing, 16 to 25 feet tall in just a matter of weeks. And so you can imagine the nutrient and water demand these things have. In some varieties, it is very true that it will grow 12 to 16 inches a day. So you can literally watch these grow. Now, there are two types of hop plants. There's male plants and there's female plants. So there's the sex of the plant is very important because mm-hmm. we only want the female flower. And that's the traditional hop cone. And the cone is the botanical term for that female flower is a strobile. And the strobile is also the female reproductive structure on a pine tree. So thus, we call them cones. Mm-hmm. Now, in the U.S., we do not want these varieties, these female flowers, pollinated by boys. Boys in the hopyard are good. So we keep them out. The flower produces round about, in the northern hemisphere here, round about the middle of July, the flower has formed and it's starting to fill these little glands underneath the little flower petals, and those are called lupulin glands. Mm-hmm. And that's where all the good stuff is. All the oils, all the bittering resins, soft resin components are inside that little tiny gland. That's what we're after as brewers and hop growers, is that gland.
Okay, so you grow them, say, July, August time frame. You get ready to harvest them. Then what do you go through? What's the next process?
Well, they're picked. Traditionally, they were picked by hand. Even some small-scale growers harvest by hand still. But there are a few commercially available small-scale harvesters on the market right now. And all the way up to, you know, these monsters they have in the Northwest. They're harvested, they're dried, which is extremely critical. Mm-hmm. In our workshops, we call hop drying how to wreck your crop in 30 minutes or less. And because it will happen that quickly. And once they're dried, they go to the processing center, or, you know, hammer milled, pelletized, vacuum sealed, you know, all that good kind of stuff. They're turned into a pellet from a whole cone.
Right. That's And then, I mean, most of us buy pellet hops now, although right. You can get plug and leaf hops, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can. But, you know, we call them T90s, the T90 pellet. They're about 6 millimeters in diameter or so, and anywhere from, 4 or 5 millimeters long all the way up to a couple centimeters. Just depends on how they come out of the dye. And, vacuum sealed in gas barrier bags, things of that nature.
Okay, so let's dive into the chemistry just a little bit. If we start at the beginning, you use hops for bittering, flavor, aroma. Mm-hmm. Most of us tend to focus real heavy on the bittering side of things.
Right.
Where does the bitterness in the hops come from?
Well, bitterness is all about that cumulone. So we call them alpha acids. Mm-hmm. Two main classes of acids, the bittering acids in hops are the alpha and the beta. Well, the beta acids add some components to the hops, but alpha acids really where all the bittering action is at. And it's a soft resin acid that is insoluble in water. So it won't dissolve into your wort. It actually has very little bittering flavor right off the plant. It's not until it's isomerized in the boil. So we need to add energy in the form of heat to force this alpha acid molecule to kind of change its shape a little bit.
So I know what are the humulones? Can you walk us through a few of the humulones people understand?
There's three main, what we call acid fractions of the alpha acid. It's humulone, cohumulone, and adhumulone. And, you know, there's some discussion now in the brewing chemistry world as to which one of those resins or all of them contribute to bittering. And there's been sort of a push, an industry push, to talk about cohumulone as contributing a harsh, as they call it, bittering. But it actually, the research done by the American Society of Brewing Chemists really hasn't been able to prove that that's the case. So we kind of group them all together as alpha acids as to what's providing the bittering power. So the jury's still out on the cohumulone component.
I know at least what I've heard, you know, humulones are desirable, right? In general.
Humulones, yes, that's your alpha acid right there. That's how we measure them. And you know, as to, you know, which fraction is the more potent bittering agent, we still don't know.
So in a lot of cases you go to the manufacturer's website and look these things up, right? Don't they have different levels for different crops quite often?
Yeah, every variety's got a range of alpha acid content. And that's established by the USDA during breeding trials. And to some extent in the newer varieties, the private industry, who's, you know, the individuals who are making these new breeds, but there'll be a range. You know, let's say you'll get a Cascade, for example, and we'll say, you know, a range of, you know, 4.9 to 7.2%, and that's percent by weight alpha acid content. That can vary. That alpha acid content can vary year to year, just due to Mother Nature in the complexities of growing a plant like this.
So just thinking off the top of my head, what makes some of the, you know, low alpha acid hops, the so-called aroma hops, you know, more desirable for finishing than, say, some of the high alpha, you know, super alpha hops?
Right. Well, that's and honestly, what we're finding in our market is we're trying to change that trend. For years and years and years, the concept was, well, you use these high bittering hops, you know, things that basically have 9% alpha and over, all the way up to, you know, 18 or 19% in something like a Newport, only for bitter, because frankly, that's what they're really, really good at. Mm-hmm. They've got a lot of bittering punch for the dollar, but they also have some very unique aromas, but people don't necessarily pay attention to those because the preconception is that they're only for bitter. Now, for the aroma type hops, so anything really that's we call them dual purpose hops, anything in that 7% alpha range and lower. Historically, you know, you would have had to add so much of these hops to get a really, really bitter beer that they were used mostly for their aromatic, you know, essential oil components, which are a completely different breed of chemical and hop. That's something, another level of hop chemistry.
Another group, huh?
Yes, completely another group. They don't, you know, the oils don't add to bittering at all. They're strictly all about the nose and the more delicate bouquet of the right. beers that you make.
Right. Well, going back to the humulones, though, you talked about isomerization. What actually goes on during this isomerization, you know, during the boil process here?
Well, if we looked at this chemical structure of an alpha acid and a beta acid side by side, they'd be remarkably similar. Mm-hmm. The difference here is that the alpha acid has not to get too crazy chemistry on you, but it has what we call a hydroxyl group, an OH group, and that's very easily dissociated from the main molecule of this alpha acid, of these humulones. What that allows the molecule to do when we add heat to it is it allows it to change its shape. Changes molecular shape. It doesn't add or subtract really any atomic structure. It just it does a little bit of a shimmy and a twist, and all of a sudden that slight twist, change in the shape of that molecule when we add heat, turns it into something that we perceive on our tongue as bitter. And something that changes the molecule's properties from insoluble in water to completely soluble. And so that's that isomerization, and that takes, you know, temperature or energy, in this case, it's temperature and time. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of cases where we're dealing with high alpha hops, you'll see add this much at this point in the boil, add this much at this point in the boil, and it takes time for those pellets to break apart and for all that cumulone in there to isomerize. And so that's generally when we talk about how long in the boil. That's what we're talking about, is how long does it take for all these alphas to isomerize into something better.
Now, one of the things I know a lot of homebrewers debate is at what temperature does that occur? Does it actually have to be boiling? Can it just be at a really high, you know, non-boiling temperature?
Right. And that answer is yes and yes. it's all about rates. So really, when we talk about these chemical reactions, we talk about energy, right, which is the heat, and time. So if you have a really, really high temperature, in a short period of time, you can get a similar effect by having a lower temperature in a longer period of time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of some commercial brewers starting to even do whirlpool hops, you know, where they're not actually boiling a lot of the hops. They still are adding some alpha acid, but...
They are, and that rate of reaction is based on temperature and time. So any way we want to play with that ratio, we can to get to the same... isomerization levels. However, what we have to be careful of is we've got other chemistries going on at the same time, mostly around volatiles. So if we threw a hop in the boil and we're going like gangbusters really hot, and we're going to go short, well, you're going to blow off quite a bit of the volatile compounds that contribute to aroma when doing that.
Sure.
Right. So it's a double-edged sword.
Well, I mean, you want to talk for a minute about the aroma compounds, these hop oils that you're talking about, the volatile ones?
Yeah, the volatile ones. And that's where we're finding the small scale hop grower, you know, almost an artisan hop grower, but that's kind of pretentious. What we can do here, we have the opportunity to go low and slow like barbecue, I tell people. You know, we dry very low temperatures, we process at very low temperatures, because these oil fractions are extremely volatile. Well, that's one reason why they have an aroma. It's because they volatilize. It's called the heat of vaporization. So there are four main oil fractions in hop oil, so to speak. It's myrcene, cumulene, caryophyllene, and farnesene. And the ratios of those fractions in the hop oil as a whole is what makes it piney or citrusy or, you know, musty or spicy or, you know, tropical fruit-like. Mm-hmm. And the tricky thing with this is all of those oils all boil at different temperatures.
Oh, wow.
So something like farnesene, which is the primary contributor in the Czech variety Saaz and the U.S. daughter Sterling, boils at 79 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
So if you're drying...
Very low.
If you're in the Pacific Northwest, they dry at 140 degrees. In their kilns. Mm-hmm. If you damage the lupulin gland at all, the farnesene that's inside of there will boil away.
Right.
So by the time they get to the kettle, their farnesene levels are nil.
Right.
And we can just keep backing up, you know, the chain there. Where, you know, myrcene boils at 280 degrees, 250 degrees. So it's going to survive the boiling work regardless.
Mm-hmm. What about the other two?
Cumulene, I believe, is a 150, and what is it, 150? These are Fahrenheit, and then caryophyllene, I believe, is a 110.
So, I mean, you wouldn't really want to steep those in a hot wort. Those would be probably better added during dry hop or something like that, right?
Exactly. Now, there's, you know, it's not so much about as soon as they, you know, they hit that temperature, they poof, they're gone.
Right.
There are other components, like in a wort, or even in dry hopping, after we've had some time for that, you know, that liquid to age a little bit, we get things like glycoproteins and other complexes in that liquid that act as almost like a soap. And they bring those oils into solution. And, you know, so you can have a higher temperature as long as we can grab onto those oil molecules and hold onto them using, you know, these solubilizing technical term of the glycoproteins and whatnot, alcohols even to some extent in the wort and the beer to hold on to these delicate oils.
So let's say I want to capture some of these in the beer. What are some of the best techniques to use to do that?
Well, you know, really what we're looking at is first we want to know what you're looking for, you know, in the oil. Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of nose and flavor are you looking for? Because that's going to really determine what oil fraction we're after and how we treat it. So let's say you want a really, what I call, you know, funky Czech Pilsner and Sterling. Those are my favorite because they do have that farnesene and they give that funky sort of, Aunt Esther's basement kind of smell to, you know,
okay,
the beer. That's something you're going to want to handle very, very carefully. And if you want to bring out the most in that, you're going to want a cooler temperature, and you're probably going to want to dry hop with it, just because you do have that those good things in that wort at that point that can suck that oil out of the hop resin profile into the liquid.
So what do some of the other ones taste like? That's great for Pilsner, obviously. What are the other three taste like? What do they remind
you of? Well, in general, so if we look at the chemical makeup of the oil fraction, myrcene makes up the lion's share. It's usually 40 to 60%. Mm-hmm. And for a while, it was considered bad, doesn't really have an aroma, you know, but actually it does. In the past 5 or 10 years now, chemists are finally agreeing that, you know what, myrcene does have an effect, and it's a very mellow, very sort of monotoned herbal note.
Okay.
And as much as I hate to admit it, in a lot of mass-produced hops, that's really all that's left. And so, as I tell some of our brewers, I said, you've got a one-note symphony here, right? There's more that can be had.
Right, because you mentioned the myrcene doesn't, you know, it doesn't even boil off, right?
Exactly.
It's always there.
Yep. So then, you know, the other thing that we'll see a lot in reports is the humulene to caryophyllene ratio. And so those are the next two down the lines. Okay. Humulene is a very stereotypical hoppy nose, and there's really no other way to describe it. And you know, the humulene being a derivative of the, you know, cumulus lupulus genus and species.
Right. So, I mean, that's a desirable aroma that you get from those low alpha hops and, right?
Exactly. You know, you'll see that even across the board with most of these varieties.
So how do you maximize that? That sounds humulene.
Well, humulene, you know, now we have to start looking at our hop varieties because its sister compound, caryophyllene, has a very citrusy component to it.
I see.
So if you're looking for humulene, which is very herbal, or caryophyllene, which is very citrusy, I mean, those two kind of fight with each other. So if you're like, you know, I'm looking for a really potent herbal pal, you're going to want something that has a high humulene and low caryophyllene. So that's the ratio you're looking for. On the other side of that.
So what variety would that be?
A nugget.
A nugget. Now,
Nugget is a very traditional bittering hop, but our brewers are starting to realize that, wow, this has got a very complex herbal note to it. And that's all about the high humulene and the low caryophyllene and the relatively low myrcene. So
I mean, I never would have thought of using Nugget for say, dry hopping or even aroma hopping, but
exactly. But, you know,
but you're saying that works.
It does work, and it depends on, you know, sort of what the malt base of the beer is. We're finding that guys are using this and gals in cream ales as an aroma addition that you would never really think of before. You're like, what are you talking about? It's like, well, look at the chemistry it's going to tell us. If we look at something more like Centennial, that's going to have a higher caryophyllene content because you get this really citrusy, bright note.
Yeah, a lot of the U.S. hops have that citrusy note. I guess it comes from that, right?
Exactly. And it comes from the ratio, you know, kind of the more humulene you add, it kind of dampens down that bright citrusy note. You go to something like a Cascade, which has, you know, a considerable amount of humulene. It's got slightly more caryophyllene, but it's also got these other oils in there, like pinene and things like that, which give it that piney, you know, a piney flair.
Sure.
So the humulene caryophyllene is something that we really have to look into when we decide, do we want more herbaceous notes or do we want more sort of bright citrusy notes?
Very cool. And what about the last one?
That's farnesene. That's the funky cousin.
And what drives that?
Well, that's the one that's in the like saws and sterling that give the Czech Pilsner their characteristic funkiness. I some people call it, you know, grassy or green apple. I don't get that at all. I get more like musty and like slightly spicy, but very, very mellow aroma out of it. And this whole concept of aromas and sort of sensory analysis is kind of a sticky wicket because it's, you know, it's a little bit different to everybody. It's hard to characterize, you know, across the board.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere that there's like 300 flavor compounds that come just from a single hop cone.
Pretty, well, exactly. And that changes when, you know, based on what time you harvest it. You know, everybody loves these, seems to be liking these, you know, wet harvest ales and whatnot, using wet hops, you know, right off the vine without drying. And what you end up with across the board is a very, what is called, you know, grassy. And it's called grassy aroma because it's the same vegetal compounds that are in grass. So when you go out and mow your grass, mow the lawn, and that smell is from a family of compounds called hexanols. And hexanols have a very, very low boiling point. And as we know, if we cut the grass, we can smell it. But it's also very easily sucked and solubilized into wort during the wet hopping process. And so you end up with these really grassy beers and you know, as harvest ales, and you either like it or you don't.
Sorry, what's dry? You said the grassy is coming from fairly young hops. Is that what's driving it?
Well, it's coming from just green vegetation. That's what's driving that grassy note in fresh green vegetation in a beer. Whereas we lose those hexanols when we dry. They're volatilized off.
Oh, I see.
So by the time we get to the cone, the dry cone, or the pellet, those things are.
So you'd have to brew with fresh hops right off the line or something that. Exactly. I know a lot of people do that. A lot of people enjoy growing them at home.
Exactly. And, you know, you get this unique characteristic of these harvest ales and, you know, and lagers. And that's where that comes from, is that hexanol.
Excellent. Well, I want to just jump back for a minute and talk about bitterness. And then we haven't really talked about betas either, so I thought we'd walk through that. But but bitterness, let's go back to the humulones and you go through this isomerization process, and then you get what we call IBUs. What's an IBU really measuring?
Well, it's just the how powerful the bittering is, and it's an arbitrary number. Well, it is, and you know, we measure that in the lab, and we do it in our lab for our brewers all the time. It's very similar to the way we measure alpha acids and hops, and it's looking at it's just a scale. It's a scale that we assign an arbitrary number to based on we use a piece of equipment called a spectrophotometer. And we're looking at, you know, absorbance. And so we're looking at what is the active, basically level of bittering compounds in this beer.
But it's primarily looking at one or two compounds, right?
Absolutely.
It's not looking across the whole flavor spectrum here.
Yeah. No, we're looking at isomerized alpha acids as well.
Right. So you're talking about they call it isohumulone at that point, or something like that. Is that right?
Yep. Isohumulones. And, you know, we basically take the number that comes off of our spectrophotometer. It's an absorbance reading, and we multiply that by two.
And it comes out a certain number. It's supposed to be a certain number of parts per million, isn't it?
You take it back to that, but it's completely arbitrary in terms of, you know, what does 102 IBUs mean?
Yeah.
Well, IBU is the unit.
But you're only measuring, you know, one out of these, you know, hundreds of different flavoring compounds. Really?
Yes, it's all just about bitter. That's it. You know, how bitter is this IPA or this Imperial IPA or this quadruple crazy over the top IPA?
That kind of leads us into the next one, which is what are these beta acids? You know, probably most people are familiar with hops. They know about alpha, and then they talk about beta.
What's a beta acid? Yeah, well, you know, where beta alphas are humulones, betas are called lupulones. And humulus lupulus.
How many of those are there?
We chemists aren't very creative. There's three, just like there are humulones. So lupulone, co-lupulone, and ad-lupulone. And so the next question is, well, what do they contribute?
Yeah.
To flavor, very little, until they go bad. and then we get the characteristic skunky, sweaty socks, rotten vegetable odor.
So if you got skunky beer, you're using old hops. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. Oxidative byproducts. So oxygen gets in and UV light hits these compounds and they break down into smaller fractions, smaller molecular components. And those have generally very distinct sensory impacts. How's that sound?
Right. But the beta acids by themselves aren't really soluble, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And they don't add a lot of flavor as a result, right?
They don't. No, sometimes they'll add some to aroma, but not enough to really, you know, pay too much attention until they go bad. And then we have trouble. The beta acids are what are primarily responsible for this bacteriostatic capability of hops, which is, you know, why they were added in such high amounts to the old school, you know.
So bacteriostatic means?
They kill off bacteria, they kill off mold spores, but...
And of course, hops plays a major role in preserving beer, right?
That's exactly where it comes from. It can do that without killing off the yeast. So it basically takes out the yeast competition. You know, and, you know, as your viewers will well know, the story behind India Pale Ales, well, there you go. I mean, they knew hops had a preservative quality, and frankly, they're trying to cover up the disgusting taste of bad beer. So you just shove a bunch more hops in this beer we're shipping to India. And, you know, during the colonial British days, and there you go, an IPA.
So, I mean, I'd expect a hop with a higher beta acid to be preserved a lot longer, right? Store much better. Is that correct? Maybe?
No, not really.
No, not really. Okay.
That comes from the issue that oxidized pretty easily. So we don't, generally those off flavors are coming from the oxidation byproducts.
I see.
And so they'll break down pretty quickly. And give us some pretty rank results.
Well, I mean, do you want to talk for just a minute about the hop storage and what happens if you don't store your hops properly and sure. How they sort of break down over time?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, again, the USDA has a storage index or storability, you know, quotient. Is it a good store or not so good store? You know, what makes up, you know, the ability of one variety or another to be a good store? Mm-hmm. I wish I could answer that. we haven't gotten quite down that path yet, figuring that one out yet. But just in general,
I can walk through what happens when it does break down as hops starts to age.
It's oxidation. It's oxygen. Same thing with the human body. You know, you get these oxygen free radicals, and they attack these vulnerable points on these molecules. Certainly, the alpha and beta acids, and then the oils are very subject to oxidation. So you get these breakdown products that have some of them have very acute sensory components to them. You get the skunky beer flavor, that light struck beer flavor. You know, in that case, it's not so much oxygen doing the damage, it's UV light. So we're really adding energy to those chemical bonds, and we're breaking those big molecules down into smaller fractions, and the results are not so great.
So it sounds like just about everything breaks down, the alpha acids, the beta acids, and I assume the hop oils, which are fragile anyways, they break down over time as well.
Correct.
Right?
Absolutely correct. And the way we avoid doing that is, you know, well, we keep oxygen and we keep light away from our hops. So how do we do that? Well, we package them in special baggage,
foil pouches.
Well, we call them barrier bags. You know, it's generally a couple different plastic laminations, and sometimes they're aluminized. The aluminum layer keeps the light out, but it doesn't do anything for anything else. We vacuum them. Vacuum packs that suck the oxygen out. We purge them with an inert gas like nitrogen to flush out any, you know, or the majority of the oxygen that's in the bag before we seal it.
And I mean, you mentioned earlier, but temperature plays a big role in storage as well, right?
Huge. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you have to refrigerate the hops, right?
Without a doubt. And we even go to the length of freezing our hops. So when they ship out, they are frozen. They come out of minus 20 or minus 30 C freezer.
Wow.
And because it's all about quality, and not that the hops have been stored that long, but it's kind of a belt and suspenders approach. They're still frozen by the time they get to the brewer. And then they can put them into their cold storage. The thing that will kill hops is once you open them, keeping them open. that I can't tell you how many times I've been in a brewery and I've seen bags of hops just sitting wide with their mouths wide open in a cooler.
Or if you go into your local brew store and they've got all the hops sitting on the shelf.
Or in clear bags, that drives me crazy. If you can see through it, that's not good. Probably the best thing for hop storage. Certainly when you're storing it in a cooler and in translucent bags under fluorescent light, that's putting out high UV. It drives me crazy. But that's why we've gone to, you know, demanding that any brew supply stores that are going to carry our hops, we package them. You can buy them in bulk and we'll give you the bulk price, but we're going to seal them properly. Because again, we're all about quality, and all those things add up to diminishing quality.
Great. Well, I thought we'd finish maybe by talking a little bit about how all this chemistry kind of comes together in the brewing process. So
sure.
So I'll pick a real simple hop thing like an IPA or something where you might have multiple hop additions. You might have dry hopping after the fact. And I was wondering if you could maybe walk us through what's actually happening as we brew an IPA.
Well, we've covered the two main activities, the bittering component and the aroma component. And to get the classic IPA, what are we looking for first is, we know it's got to be bitter. So we're going to be focusing on utilization, right? What's our best conversion in the boil on the hot side for isomerizing these alpha acids, for getting the biggest bang for our buck in the bittering component. We also keep in mind, sort of while we're doing that, late additions to the hot side can create bittering like we talked about, but it can also help to start bringing in some of these oil fractions. So late in the boil, and as the temperatures are coming down, we can start thinking of, we can still get bitter, but now what sort of foundation do I want to build for the aroma component? Because we can get those more robust oils, the humulene and the myrcene, into solution at that point.
Well, one question I get quite a bit is how late is good? Because, people talk about, 20 minutes being a late hop addition. And I personally think that's a little bit long. What's your opinion on that?
Well, what I think a lot of folks find, and they may not understand why it's happening, is, you've got hops in at, for a long boil. And you're going to get great utilization, maybe. Look at the conversion rates I'm getting. But you're also basically, you're cooking vegetable matter. And what do you get out of that? You get these cooked vegetal esters coming over into the beer.
Sure.
And so you get that, this is great, but I kind of don't like cabbage in my beer flavor. And I think that's what's happening. People are maybe, that have the tendency to boil for that long or have that addition in that long in that kind of heat, need to look at a higher alpha hop at a shorter length, at a shorter period of time, to eliminate sort of that overcooking the vegetable component.
So that's for the boil. What about late? When you talk about a late hop addition, what's a good time frame for that? Is it 10 minutes, 5 minutes? What are we talking about? If you want to actually preserve some of those oils as you're walking through.
Well, I think we're going to want to keep it in there, sometime around, that 5 minute range. It's enough to get some bump from the alpha through conversion, but you realize you're not going to convert all of that alpha in that short period of time, certainly when the temperature's coming down. So, but it's going to start to solubilize a good portion of those oils. And to give you that foundation around that 5 minute mark or so. Mm-hmm. And then certainly when the heat's off and we're going over onto the cool side, as the temperature's dropping, really, if we can get down to a wort temperature that's, 120 degrees or less, now we're really focusing on aroma and you're going to get very little isomerization.
So, I think that's an important point, though. If you're going to use these things to steep them as you're coming down, for example, mm-hmm. you're going to take an aroma addition and add it during the whirlpool or add it as you're cooling down. You probably don't want to drop those in right after you turn off the flame, right? I mean, you really want to wait till the thing comes down quite a bit.
Right. We've got this great, great, extremely complicated tool called a thermometer. use it. And, keep in mind those sort of temperatures that I talked about, these oils flashing off at, that's really when they become really available for these other chemicals in the wort now to glob onto.
So, you'd actually hold off and steep at, say, 120 degrees or 110 degrees or something like that, right?
You're going to get the biggest aroma bang in that range because you're going to activate, solubilize, as we call it, the oils out of that hop, pellet or cone, and make them, you're adding enough heat, enough energy to make them active, but you're also, before they can flash off, they're going to get grabbed onto by some of these other, glycoprotein complexes, and they're going to pull them into solution at that point. But if you add them too hot, you know, at 180 degrees,
right,
you're going to create more of a situation where they're going to flash off and you're not going to grab them. They're just too excited.
I know a lot of people tend to add them at flame out, which is not really the right answer here.
Well, you know, again, if you're looking for, you know, that big herbal, you know, poppy note, and you don't want some of these other complexes, that's probably okay, because that's what you're going to grab more of anyway. They just have higher boiling points. But, you know, the lower boiling point components are going to poof, be gone.
And then what about dry hopping?
Well, that's where you're going to get all of the full potential of properly, you know, dried and pelletized hop, because there's, you know, heat is not a component now. Certainly not so much, but you have a more mature liquid that has the ability to get in there and solubilize, again, acting almost like soap, those oils, and pull them into solution, but it's going to take a long time, right? So steep those hops and put them on, you know, in the dry hopping phase for, you know, much, much longer. You know, I can't tell you exactly how long for given, you know, temperature and hop type and all that.
I mean, what's a reasonable dry hop time, though? Is it 2 days, 3 days?
The
secondary?
Well, I mean, that can be a little bit, you know, the whole time. That can get a little bit overpowering. You end up with, you'll end up with a lot of these sort of solvent characters, you know, that, you know, turpentine-like character if you overhop in the dry hop phase. You know, I would say, you know, no more than a couple of days, you've pretty much extracted everything that's going to be to extract in a homebrew type of system. Certainly, if you're doing it in a chilled liquid, room temperature, you know, certainly 2 days is going to be fine.
Well, James, I really appreciate you being on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, no, I really appreciate you being on here. I think there's a lot there's a lot of potential to be had if, you know, just better understanding, you know, this, the hop as a flower and how complex it is, and, you know, what's available for people to play around with. And, that's one of our big mission statements is making sure people, you know, have the exposure to the information. So appreciate you being on the show.
Well, I certainly learned a lot, and you know, I really appreciate what you're doing, and I wish you all the luck.
Thank you.
Great to see some small hop growers taking off in other areas of the country. So
we're trying.
So thank you for that. And again, my guest was James Altwise. He's at Gorse Valley Hops at gorsevalleyhops.com, and they sell both to commercial brewers and to home brewers. Well, I'd like to say thank you again to James Altwise for appearing on the show from gorsevalleyhops.com. If you have feedback for the show, you can go to beersmith.com/blog, leave a message on our discussion forum. At beersmith.com/forum, either place, you can look up this episode and leave a message for us. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.